welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this segment of the Hagman and the Hagman Report. Our very special guest tonight, Mr. Stan Dale, standale.com. That's standale.com. Bookmark his website. Of course, go to his website, bookmark his website. Check out the show images page as you go along today. For those listening, I just want to mention that portions of this broadcast brought to you by Holtones. HoltonesLive.com. Have you gone there yet, folks? Do so. What a great opportunity for you to enjoy one of life's greatest pleasures, music. Folks, HoltonesLive.com is what I'm referring to. If you're sick and tired of being stressed, if you're overwhelmed, if you feel unmotivated, if you feel like life is running you instead of you running your life, well, you're not alone. We're all in the same boat. Finally, however, you can experience the scientifically proven powers of music therapy with Whole Tones. They've got a collection of proven music therapy that can help you reduce your stress, ease your mind, and motivate you. You can get started today. Listen to a free sample of this amazing music that heals and inspires. Where? Well, it's at WholeTonesLive.com. That is with a W, W-H-O-L-E. As in whole, wholetoneslive.com. One of many happy emailers, and we have had so many, but one client said, you know, I started playing Whole Tones throughout my workday. Not only was I more creative and motivated, the work I was doing seemed much easier, and I was much clearer. We had Michael Terrell on our show, and he did explain how this music was inspired by the music frequencies of King David. And what a great show that was. Support this show and go to WholeTonesLive.com to get a free sample of this soothing, relaxing, revitalizing musical tones. Go to the URL, WholeTonesLive.com, for your free sample, and then just have at it. You won't be sorry. Got a picture, by the way, of Greg Jackson, CD by the radio, his radio he sent some time ago, and saying he loves it. And I just want to say thanks, Greg, for that. So go to the website, download a free sample at WholeTonesLive.com. Support this broadcast. That's WholeTonesLive.com.
And again, tonight, our guest, Stan Dale, we're going to bring him on in just a sec. Before we do, I just want to ask everybody out there, for those of you who have been listeners of the show, you know that Stan has come on every Tuesday for years now. He's been our guest every Tuesday evening, and we just ask that you keep him and Holly in your prayers, as Stan's been battling with some pains he's been having. It's been a reoccurring issue, and we ask all the prayer warriors out there to keep him and Holly in your prayers, and prayers of healing for Stan.
Indeed, and you know what, folks, Stan Dale does not have to do any of this. He comes on for us, and he makes a big sacrifice. When I say he doesn't have to do it, I mean he doesn't need the hassle of the weekly broadcast, but he does because he cares about all of us, and his knowledge is phenomenal, and he's got a commitment to the larger agenda, and he's doing the work of God. He's a great guy. And we're just so honored to have him. It really, I'm Joe, high school, getting you out of bed in the morning, listening to Coast AM with Stan Dale on.
He used to drag me out of bed 4:30 in the morning, 5 in the morning to listen to Coast.
Never thought that
sometimes
I'd ever
cook me eggs Benedict, but
yes, I got good at that, but never thought we'd ever have the honor of actually speaking with Stan Dale face to face. But here we are.
Stan, it's great to have you back.
I'm
on
blushing,
the show.
Guys. Stop that.
Well, it's all true, buddy.
Okay, good evening. I've been listening to Steve and to Gary with you guys in the first 2 hours. Well, I'll tell you what, it's pretty spooky, that scenario they paint in that movie he's making.
Yeah. You know, it's something that you've talked about that we've been looking at. Joe and I went to, I think we
one
told you this.
One second after.
Yeah.
It was in Buffalo, hosted by the writers of the book, One Second After, the EMP disaster.
Right. There were a whole bunch of government officials there when we were there, and they were like, I don't even know how to describe it. They were
dumbfounded.
Verklempt. Is that a word? I mean, just their mouths were hanging open saying, oh my goodness, this could be bad. This will be bad. But anyway, if $2 billion is all it's going to take to fix it, what, really? I mean, can't we fix it? You think?
No. No. I agree with Gary. I don't think we can, with Gary on this, I don't think we can fix it at this late date, but we need to prepare for it. And you're right. We've talked about this many times on the shows about the need for people to prepare, and Gary brought that up, you know, get your food, medicine, you know, your weapons, whatever you need. One thing that I had to go do a bit of research just before the show, and I missed part of what he was saying, but I did hear him start to discuss, you know, countries to go to, like, you know, Australia and various other places, New Zealand. And I just wanted to put our two cents in worth about that, because Holly and I have been and lived overseas in Australia. And, you know, you don't want, as an American, to go offshore to avoid what's happening here. You need to form community, be ready to, well, as he pointed out, go into the wilderness as the woman is chased, or, you know, taken into the wilderness by the wings of the Messiah. You need to be able to trust friends and family. If you go overseas, I guarantee you, when America is in strife, you will be in strife there, because you're no longer protected by America, and they consider most Americans to be rich Yanks or spies from the CIA or something, and you will be at a great disadvantage, if not dead, in friendly countries.
Yeah, and we're neither rich nor spies.
And you'll be blamed. Yeah. You'll be blamed, yep, for everything going wrong. You know, I mean, we've already seen it over there at dinner discussions with, you know, a banker and various other people there in Australia. And they just do not understand the American culture. But, you know, for what some Americans have done in other countries, what some Americans have caused harm overseas, all Americans are tarred and feathered with overseas. And you just will be unprotected and an orphan in some foreign country, even if you speak the same language. So we, you know, we looked at that, and having been over there, we advise people, don't go overseas, stay here, form communities, form escape plans, form whatever you need to stay here and defend yourself and your friends and family. So it's just, I mean, Steve Quayle and I have talked about this many times on his show, too. You need to get stuff that you will need: food, water, medicine, you know, guns, communication, just, you know, all kinds of things that you will need when society fails us and there are gangs roaming in your neighborhood. And one of the biggest things is community, you know, make friends with your neighbors. And, you know, not just casual friends, dinners, and do things together, because you need to have friends around you. You just cannot be an island. And I think what his movie is showing, or will show when it's released, is, you know, a frightening thing, but very realistic to what we think will happen when the EMP hits us. I don't know whether he showed this in the movie, but as soon as our infrastructure is down, you know, our power grid and communication, you can bet your bottom dollar Russia and China will hop on us like a duck on a June bug.
I believe that to be true. Regardless of what, you know, I believe that to be true. And I just want to take this opportunity to tell people, if you haven't got Dare to Prepare yet, I mean, that is the ultimate preparation handbook, manual, encyclopedia by Holly Deo, Dare to Prepare. Folks, please get it now while you still can, before it's too late.
One of the most popular, if not the most popular, preparedness books, and it's been around for a long time.
Yeah, and this isn't about to sell books. This is about to be prepared, and I think, I mean, we consult that book often. So anyway, I just want to make sure that people do have that, and take the opportunity now. Go to standale.com and order Dare to Prepare, because we really need that. Mm.
And also on that site, guys, there's a, you know, a heap of free prep information up in the very left-hand corner there of the page. You will see little orange boxes, and there's preparation, free prep info. You go to that sub-website, and there are links in there to suppliers of all kinds of stuff. There's free Excel program there that you can download to calculate how much of what kind of food and medicine you need for how many people for how many weeks. And I wrote that one. There's a nuclear biological, like NBC prep info, how to survive, you know, in a near nuclear hit, and the fallout, where it goes, and how you can survive in your home if you make a little preparation now. So there's a lot of important things here that you can just go up there and download the heck out of. You better do it, for we don't have internet anyway. Yeah. That's that's the site. And as you said, there's a show images page there where you can click to see. It's down by that little blue microphone. You can see some of the things we might be addressing here today shortly. Yeah, go on.
No, I was just going to ask you something, Stan. I know that we had some things that we were going to talk about, but I just kind of want to get your take, your gut feeling. I mean, you're a guy that is paying attention to a lot of things, and regardless of your level of knowledge about the intricacies of what happened with the death of Antonin Scalia, yeah, what's your gut telling you about this? I mean, if anything, do you have any comments or concerns, or I mean, which, you know, from your analysis?
Well, knowing how Obama is just such a forget the law type guy, overriding the law like a dictator almost, and knowing that he's only got whatever it is, 17 months left in office, or is that right? No, no, not that long.
No, less than that. Yeah. Less than a year.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe a year, whatever. And knowing that he wants to, if he does turn the reins over to some other president, which, again, is doubtful in my mind that we'll even have a free election, but if he does go that way and he's going to take another position, say, with the United Nations or something, the Secretary General, by stacking the Supreme Court to the left or liberal, you know, with a appointment of a very left-wing Supreme Court judge, then he can direct things here in the United States through the Supreme Court, even though he's over, you know, in the UN building in New York, he can still do it. So yes, I'm thinking it's a happy circumstance for him that Scalia died right here when he's got the time to, where Obama has the time to appoint the guy he wants. You know, other than suspicions, I have no proof. I mean, I've read the reports, you know, that have been circulating on the internet, but it just may be an unhappy circumstance that the good Lord allowed to happen because we've turned away from him here in this country. I don't know.
It's a good, interesting you'd say. I mean, God allowing this to happen to this nation, kind of as a
and I can,
judgment.
And I absolutely can see that as a possibility. What definitely doesn't sit right with me, and I know does not sit right with my dad, was the lack of following of the standard operating procedures of investigation, especially after death, and how this was handled, especially with such a high-ranking government official. You'd think that they would...
And no autopsy.
Right. And embalmed. And we, you know, Texas has that law that you have to, before a body is moved out of state, you have to have, you know, it has to be embalmed. However, really... And even at my low-level capacity, you know, in my capacity as a first responder as well as an investigator, look, I mean, there's really a procedure about unattended deaths. You follow a certain pattern, and when you deviate from that pattern is when you get in trouble. So, this really,
It stinks. I grant you that.
Well,
thanks, Lord. We are in trouble. Before we started the program this evening, Joe, I was talking to you about the Middle East being a Balkan powder keg, and I noticed there was this kind of thoughtful silence over in your part, and I said, do you know what the Balkan powder keg is? And you kind of heard of it, you think. When I was in school, which is, you know, last century, probably 60 years ago, it was part of our history lessons, and the reason it's important in what we're discussing in the Middle East, what we're seeing in the news today, is it's a repeat of the thing that started World War One. Now, you can go look this up, look up the powder keg of Europe, and you can see what I'm going to tell you. But in the Middle East, you know, you've got Syria sitting in the middle of Greece and Turkey and Iran and Russia coming down from the north and Saudi Arabia. You know, all these different people on the edge of Syria trying to carve a hunk out, including ISIS, which has no state. But if you go back and look at history, in Europe, the Ottoman Empire was still kind of functioning at World War One, and Bulgaria and Serbia were in the center of vying powers trying to carve up Europe and get parts of what they wanted. Italy, Austria, Hungary, and Germany kind of were in a coalition, say, you know, the Green Coalition on the left, and Russia, France, and Great Britain were on the, say, Blue Coalition on the right. Actually, I suppose I should flip them, but anyway, geographically. And the Ottoman Empire kind of semi-allied with Germany and part of Bulgaria. Now, Russia wanted Serbia. Austria-Hungary and the Ottoman Empire claimed chunks of Bulgaria. And Russia wanted Serbia, sorry. So I'm looking at all these things, and I see a central piece of territory being fought over by alliances that were drifting back and forth. And although I said Italy, Austria, Hungary, and Germany were together, and the Ottoman Empire was kind of on the edge of that, there were things going on behind the scenes like there are now in the Middle East, which made it an absolute nightmare to figure out who was going to flinch or blink first. And, you know, it, what happened, you know, there was a nut that assassinated Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria and his wife. And she was a Hohenberg, a German. And so what happened was this lit the spark that blew up Europe into World War One, killing millions of people in the process. Anyway, study a little bit about the powder keg of Europe, and you'll get kind of an idea why I put the maps up on the show images page of the Middle East.
Okay.
And in fact, if you want to just go to the show images page to the second row, first image, it's a map. And it's a map I just took off of Google showing the Middle East players. So you can see where Greece and Turkey and Iran and Iraq and Syria, Saudi Arabia, you can see where they all are relative to each other, because this is important. Look at Syria. Syria is sitting in the map in the very center. Turkey is above it. Greece is to the left of it. Iran is to the right of it. Iraq is to the right of it. Saudi Arabia is to the south of it. And ISIS is in the middle of it, and the United States is offshore on the left side coming over. But you see Syria, like Bulgaria and Serbia, is in the middle of all these vying countries. And the weird thing about it is that, like, say, Greece and Turkey, they're at odds with each other. They're not happy with each other. And Greece has been making overtures, which you can click on, let's see, the second row, pictures of Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras going over to make a deal with Iran, and he's been over making a deal with Israel. So you've got Greece making deals with Israel and Iran. Then you've got Turkey trying to attack the Kurds and to irritate the heck out of Iran, if not have a war with them. And so Greece and Turkey are at odds. But now Turkey is also down in Israel like Greece is, and it's trying to make a deal to be friendly with Israel to import Israel's gas from the Mediterranean, you know, Leviathan field. Saudi Arabia and Russia, two of the other players in this game, have decided that they're going to go together and freeze oil prices. Now, typically they don't get along, but now Saudi Arabia and Russia are doing that, and several of the countries in the region are thinking about seriously giving up the U.S. dollar as the petrodollar and going to other currencies. If that happens, that agreement, the day that happens, we'll have an almost overnight collapse of our share market as the U.S. dollar collapses. So all this stuff in the entire world centers right now on Syria and everybody in that area fighting. Of course, you've got Russia supporting Assad, the president of Syria, and you've got Russia saying they're against ISIS, but they're not doing much. You got the American government, you know, and I'm not talking about the military, I'm just talking about the government, the dinglings, who aren't really putting boots on the ground over when they needed to, doing kind of token air support here and there. And, you know, I don't know really who to trust as going to be in the final alliances there. Turkey is threatening to send 35,000 Syrian refugees across the little bay there over to Athens. And, of course, Cyprus and Greece says, oh, no, don't do that. And it's got Europe all in a tither about it. You know, this is just a nightmare, an absolute nightmare. Throw a spark in the middle of it, and it will erupt into a nuclear confrontation somehow. And we're there. We're there by the minute as Saudi Arabia and other allies that it's gotten, Egypt and various others, to come in and form a 350,000-man army to invade ISIS in Syria. you know, wow. I just...
To me, Stan, it's obvious that... I mean, going back to the Arab Spring, which was not spontaneous in my view. Well, not just in my view, but the documentation will prove or shows that there's discussions for the Arab Spring. But going back, even back then...
2011.
Yeah, 2011. And then Benghazi, of course. But it just seems to me like right now, we're at war with Russia, aren't we? I mean, there's really, whether by proxy or soon, you know, toe-to-toe.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. You're underlining the problem we've got trying to figure out who the good guys and the bad guys are, if there are any.
Yeah. I was trying to connect the dots, man, and I'll tell you something. I had to use duct tape to wrap my head because you've got like five different corners and five different alliances, and it's just ridiculous.
Somebody's going to have to blink in some of those alliances. You know, they've made alliances, but the alliances can be broken, you know, at the stroke of a pen or blink of an eye. I mean, I told you Saudi Arabia and Russia are going to, you know, freeze price. They're also going to freeze oil output, which is because they reckon we've got a glut of oil. So if they're not putting oil out, it may turn around and make oil prices go up. I'm not sure. But Russia and Saudi Arabia getting together. Now, what's our deal with Saudi Arabia and the United States? We're Cold War with Russia, but now we couldn't afford to be in a Cold War with Saudi Arabia. But yet, that's kind of how this Russian-Saudi alliance, which is forming now then over oil, is forcing the situation. Oil. Can I tell you, oil seems to be one of the major factors in this whole thing, energy.
And correct me if I'm wrong, too. When we talk about oil, a lot of people kind of want to simplify oil and the cost of oil, the price per barrel, but a lot of the oil, or again, correct me if I'm not stating this properly or if I'm off base, but aren't we talking about the cost of, the lift costs and the differences between getting it from Saudi Arabia or fields under their control versus, we'll say, North Dakota? I don't know, as an example. You're talking about different lift costs. And
what do you call it? What do you say, lift costs?
Lift costs.
Yeah, the cost to get the oil out of the ground.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, right.
Or is that not a factor, or is that a factor?
Oh, yeah, of course it's a factor, but it's a very complex equation, as you might guess. Cost of getting the oil out, cost of processing, cost of shipping, cost of pipelining, defensive pipelining, if you're doing that, and defensive shipping. I wrote the prime minister over there to Israel and to his department of like the USGS equivalent, NTM, saying, look, you know, you need to look for oil in the Golan, sorry, not the Golan Heights, in the Megiddo Plain. Just kind of touches the hill of Megiddo. It's just north of Nazareth, the territory of Nazareth there, but Zion Oil has actually been given permission to start drilling on the southern tip of that. Now, then, that area I pointed out to them, but they need to have oil there in that area strategically, their own oil, because they can only supply about oil for enough for themselves out of their own wells in Israel. They can only supply about 40 days worth of oil, and they're out, and that's their total reserves. So, gas, yes, but oil, no. That oil, that Afic oil, which Cheney and some others have put money into up in the Golan Heights, is part of Syria. It's in a contested demilitarized zone that Israel occupies there in southern tip of Syria. And you know, anybody with a brain would say, well, you can't depend on that huge oil supply you've just dug there or drilled there to help Israel in a time of war, because you can guarantee with all those nuts running around in Syria with guns, bombs, troops, and everything, it only takes a 1.5 hour, if that much, deviation from whatever they're fighting to go down and blow up the oil well there that's just been drilled in, Golan Heights. It's not a place to put your strategic resource for fuel and energy. So anyway, I see signs of Israel doing that onshore. There are little kind of hills, and, you know, they're not big mountains, but there are hills surrounding that Megiddo Plain so that they could mount some air defense for fields there, and they could bury some or do them underground so that nobody knows where they are and that kind of stuff. Well, you know, satellites could probably pick most of them. But anyway, it would be easier to defend there in the Megiddo on their own dirt than it would be across the Jordan, across the Sea of Galilee, up in the Golan Heights, or out in the Mediterranean. I mean, torpedo submarines, marine surface vessels could absolutely wipe out your gas and oil wells in the Mediterranean. And Israel doesn't have that big of a navy. So you can see the oil, the underscore problem here with the oil is huge. Years ago, a physicist, or a physics major, sorry, I guess he was a physicist too, who was also a rabbi, became a good friend of mine, and he spent time in Israel, and he said to me, look, we know we have a deep oil supply underneath Israel, but the Arabs have already told us in the surrounding countries, if you ever tap into that and start marketing it, we will consider that a declaration of war, because your wells would be down, you know, deeper than ours, and you would be sucking oil out of our wells. And the, of course, the response back, which was correct, was, yeah, but our well being down to, our reservoir being down to bottom, lower than you guys, is under great pressure. And that's why when you go to get oil, it tries to blow out your pipelines. It comes up under pressure. So you are, in essence, you're draining our pressurized oil field. So the argument goes back and forth. But that oil pool is there. In fact, I've, you know, learned from my dad, who was a petroleum geologist, how to analyze a lot of these things. And there are, as I've said on your program a few months back, there are two underground formations that are like valleys, like reservoirs, kind of longish but deep. And those, one of those, in fact, both of them do connect back up to the Afik oil deposit underground. And there's a fault line where the oil that was in Afik was trapped, and the rest of it went down into Israel. I'm just almost positive of it. And even the Bible supports that with the type of rock that Israel would find over the oil. And it's a flinty stone, and that's that kind of particular stone has a definite character. And I've, you know, when you scan over the terrain, and I found the two locations there at the, well, it, south, no, see, what would it be? About east and south of Haifa and on the edge of the Megiddo Plain. That might be the very reason that, you know, they have the Battle of Megiddo, you know, Armageddon, in that area over oil. Who knows? Who knows?
Very interesting. And I know we've talked about this before, but it's always good to keep this in the forefront because, you know, motive, means, opportunity, especially when we're talking with in terms of crime scenes and war, you know, and biblical conflict. Well, all right.
Madam. Yeah, I know. I expect to get up any morning now then, turn on the tube and see war in the Middle East. And it won't be just there. When that happens, because of what Russia will have to do to support its Arab allies by treaty there, they will have to, Russia will have to neutralize the United States. And whether Russia actually does the EMP or does a nuke attack, or whether North Korea does it from orbit, doesn't matter. As soon as it escalates over there, you can be holding on to your backside, because it's going to be a rough ride over here immediately. You're not going to look at a big delay at all. Which gets back to the thing, you should be hunkering down, getting what you need. You won't be able to go to the store or travel freely if they impose martial law in a, you know, kind of nuclear war scenario or an invasion scenario. It's coming.
Exactly. Yeah, it is. And I think sooner, like you said, I mean, we don't know when, but I would say sooner than later. And people might say, well, you know, you've been saying that for a long time. And my reply would be, well, it's even more true now, isn't it? You know, I mean, it's...
Well, you saw that Walmart cut, you know, shut, what, several hundred of its stores around the place, you know, the planet.
And 269, yeah.
How many?
269 stores.
Right, okay. Well, we shop there because it's right, the supercenter right close to us. And Holly goes in there and talks with the staff and things like that. And she was in this morning, and looking around for various things that she normally buys, and was noticing holes in the shelf. No product, no product. And she was talking to some of the staff, and I said, "Oh, I don't know, you know, why that happened, but yeah, right. When you close 269 stores and certain things start disappearing off your stock list, you're reducing inventory. You're in trouble. And that's not the only American company that's in trouble. So when this is on your doorstep, that's another pressure for, you know, a complete civil disorder breakdown over economy, over food. And we could be seeing people fighting over food very shortly, just like it was before a hurricane, except it's going to be bigger."
Yeah, and Stan, one of the things about Walmart, I've been doing a lot of research on RFID and its various uses. Walmart installed a inventory system which tagged every piece of merchandise that they brought in with RFID tags. So they knew when, you know, X amount of coffee makers, we'll say, were to be sold on a certain day, that they had to restock those coffee makers because of the RFID tags they had on them. So they knew exactly the number they had on the shelves versus how many were sold that day, knowing how much more to order to put back on the shelves. So there should be no reason that Walmart would be or should have empty shelves unless there was some kind of, you know, accident or delay in a certain shipment. But what you're describing sounds much out of the ordinary from what I understand how they operate.
Okay, well, and this is a super center, so, you know, that's their big stores. And we've been watching it. It's something that should be of concern to a lot of us.
You know, we are our resident Baltic Dry Index expert, Larry M. from Santa Clarita, California. We've been talking about the Baltic Dry Index. But,
it was up 6 points to 301 today.
Okay. But Stan, is this, I guess help me out here. It's my understanding this is a composite of indices, but does this affect things like televisions and electronics, or is it just mainly for commodities like, you know, foodstuffs and grain and such? Or is it a combination of both? And really, does it matter? I guess, I don't know.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, does it matter is a good question. I do think that Baltic Dry Index does take into heavy consideration, like weighted heavily in favor of how many seatainers, how many ships are doing commerce, how many dollars worth of trade is going on. And it has been an indicator that's been quite accurate for recessions, shall we say, but this is going to be a lot worse than that. So it has its place. But I think the major player is going to be the eruption of war in the Middle East. What I'm concerned about with that is Israel is connected right on this, you know, the Galilee there to the southern tip of Syria. And you might also look at, instead of the modern Balkan crisis focused on Syria, it'd be focused on Syria and Israel, because the anti-Israel, anti-Semitic, they say, but it's anti-Israel sentiment, is huge in the world and growing by day. So, look at all those countries that are gathering together ostensibly to go after ISIS or after Syria or Iran, you know, or the Kurds, and, oh, wait a minute, they're gathering all these troops and munitions right over the top of Israel. And, you know, if the alliances were suddenly to go the other way, well, you'd see those 20,000 tanks, those 2,450 warplanes, and 400 or 500 military helicopters, and 350,000 soldiers that Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Jordan and Bahrain and Oman and Qatar, they've all been putting those into the area to fight over in Syria, and it's just a fall down the hill, you know, like an hour, hour and a half maximum, to get down to the Afik oils and Golan Heights and go right into northern Israel. So we have to watch that. Now, Israel's watching this, and I am certain, especially after, you know, Obama let some of the information out about the nuclear arsenal that they determined that Israel had back in the 50s and 60s, that Israel has gone far beyond that and has developed tactical nuclear devices. And I think because they are so small, people-wise and land-wise, and so besieged on all sides, that there will come a moment here shortly where they will unleash the dogs of war, which are nuclear, on those that are trying to invade and, you know, take them down and kill them. That would include Iran. That would include Syria, you know, if Assad gets, you know, control of his country again, or if not, ISIS and Assad, possibly Turkey. I doubt they'd hit Turkey, but you see what I'm saying? The Israeli factor in this is another wild card. Like you had like Bulgaria and Serbia in the Balkan powder keg. Well, if Serbia was like Syria and Bulgaria is like Israel, they're all in the middle of it. You know, it's just an incredibly bad situation.
Yeah, I don't think very many people in the United States really understand or have a clue about this. Maybe what's taking place in the Middle East, and especially not about the massive escalation.
We've never been closer to a world war than we are now since you know, the beginnings of World War One or Two. Just as Stan had said,
that's right. Yeah.
Well,
yeah, man,
people just really cannot afford to ignore this. I know you and I both know, or all three of us know, that it's a mind bender to try to figure out who's allied with who, and you know who's up and who's going where in the Middle East. But that's no excuse for not trying to understand, not trying to figure out what's happening, because a lot of people sit down with their morning coffee and turn on Fox News or CBS or whatever, CNN, and, okay, what's today's news? And in Iran, blah, blah, blah. Oh, yeah, yeah, come on, get to the good stuff, local stuff. They think it's all over there, and those that think, well, yeah, it is over there, and it might affect us, but it's just too hard, I'm going to drink my coffee and go to work. And that's the problem. They're going to get caught short, when everything happens. I mean, people don't realize that famine, shortage of food on the shelves, is only 3 days away if all trucking stops, and trains and stuff like that. I mean, 3 days of food on the shelves in the stores. Oh, well.
It's amazing to even think about. And I want to reaffirm that, or just make mention of this again, if you didn't hear, Stan and ladies and gentlemen, Saudi Arabia, their jets had, the Pentagon is reporting that the Saudi Arabian F-16 warplanes took part in a bombing raid on ISIS over the weekend, of course, but...
And Russia continues its bombing campaign. Of ISIS in Syria, and subsequently they hit a hospital, a maternity ward, and a school, and they've been.
And Doctors Without Borders were in there, weren't they?
Yeah.
That's the report anyway. Yeah, it's the Kurds. They're creating a Kurdish state that includes northern Iraq, the entire Syrian Turkish Iraq border, I guess one can say. And Turkey is not happy about that. You've got in addition to the proxy wars and the us versus them, you've got the tribal, aspect of this too.
And that's what governments use, by arming and funding and supporting those local tribal peoples to fight against each other to make pathways for what their agenda is and what they want to bring in.
Well, in that image, I've got the middle image there on the second row of the Middle East on Google Earth. If you look at that and look at Iraq's border, you'll see up the northeastern border is up near Lake Urmia. You can see that in blue. That whole corner up there is where the Kurdish occupy various portions of it. It's not totally Kurdish, but they have tribal areas within that. And that's where they want to try to, Israel's been trying to get the Kurds to tie into a pipeline in Iraq down the southern part or middle part of it and go through the Syrian desert, but it's not part of Syria, over into Jordan and then across into Israel. So it could have an oil pipeline coming from the Kurds, because right now 75% of all the oil Israel gets in is Kurdish oil, and they have been sending it up through the Kurds have up through their northern border to Turkey, over through a pipeline to Turkey, and then I guess it goes from there onto ships or something down to Israel. But the oil situation is, again, the zipper, the spark, I would hate to be the Prime Minister of Israel at the moment. Poor man.
Yeah. Yeah, that's...
I found an interesting but not warfare type thing. When I was looking at the Glen Heights and the Affect oil and stuff like that, I found something that is biblical but really kind of cool. If you go to the third row of my site there, the Show Images page on the right-hand side, you'll see and read where Jesus spoke to and fed the 5,000. And if you click that map, you will see kind of a little red pointer with a black dot pointing down to a place called Tabgha, which is right next to Capernaum. Remember that from the Bible. Now, to the right of that, straight across, and just you know, what's called the Kanaf, you'll see that there, straight across the Sea of Galilee to the right, is where the Affect oil thing is in the Golan Heights. Now, I just found it interesting that directly across from where that oil is there in Golan Heights is where Jesus spoke to the 5,000 and fed them. And if you go back to the Show Images page, third row in the middle, you'll see an enlargement of the place where they say you could feed 5,000 to 7,000 people. You could see them there in the mountainside and in a little cove. And they, you know, that's pretty much, I mean, I've been in that area there. You can speak in that area, and your voice is somehow carried up the hill acoustically. It's a really good thing. And, you know, you can, I guess everyone can hear all the way up to the side of the mountain there, and you can see exactly that Jesus was speaking his parables and his peace there.
Like an amphitheater. What they call it.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it, it's an amphitheater, natural amphitheater, and it's called by the locals the Cove of the Sower, or the Cove of the Parables. And, you know, I tell you, the acoustics, natural acoustics, are just mind-blowing. I mean, you can see how a guy, Jesus, could stand right down there at the seashore and speak up to there, and they would all hear it. You know, they'd get quiet, but they'd hear it. And, of course, being right there next to the Sea of Galilee with his fishermen who were disciples, and they got some fish and baskets and loaves of bread, and that's where the miracle of the blessing of the loaves and the breads fed 5,000 people. And that is a peaceful, wonderful thing right across the Sea of Galilee from Golan Heights, where it's going to be, you know, the gateway to come and invade Israel. I just thought it was interesting. I'd forgotten about it after years of not being there in Israel, and ran across it when I was looking at all these maps, and thought I'd share that with you folks. Is, you know, look and see where it's true. That's from the Bible. That's where Jesus stood and spoke to so many people.
Well, that's awesome, Stan, and thank you so much for posting this picture. Actually, my wife just ordered a brand new printer specifically for printing pictures, high-quality pictures, and I'm going to see if I can't make this the first picture that we print out with that, so I can hang that up on my wall.
Link onto the site. Link onto the, if you go to the printed comment down underneath, it says see and read. Click to there, and you'll go to a Christian Guy's website. And, you know, he says, you know, it's not for commercial purposes, but you guys, he has a copyright kind of thing that lets you just print that stuff up for your own thing. It's called a photo permission. And you might email him and get a better resolution than the one that we see online, because, you know, those are okay. But, you know, for what you want to do with that printer, and go to his page and look at it. I mean, it's such an incredible thing to see all the research he's done on it, and the pictures he's taken from the air, and the map on the ground showing, you know, how many feet and, you know, how many people could sit there and who did the research. And anyway, that's all.
So interesting.
You feel like touching on Pope Francis' little Book of Wisdom, the Essential Teachings, anything?
Well, yeah. What have we got here? About 9 minutes or so. I'll get to that in a minute, because we'll run out of time on that one for sure. But okay. I have up the top of the Show Me's page a ball of little squigglies of red and green things, and if you click on that, it will take you to the Guardian page, where they talk about many brains could revolutionize drug research and reduce animal use. Okay, they are growing these balls from of brain cells that are all linked together and firing, you know, messages back and forth, functioning as a little mini brain in a ball shape. Now, this ball of brain cells that they're growing in these dishes, is each one is about the size of the head of a ballpoint pen. Now, that's tiny. But what you see them doing here for testing various drugs and things like that process can also be used to grow little brains that you put onto silicon chips and you integrate into a super, almost human computer. Because the human mind works so much faster in logic and various other things than our fastest computers. If you were to make a computer that was living on a silicon chip, and could be linked together with other balls like this, Lord only knows what kind of a thinking, living organism you would get. But wow. In the time of the Antichrist, this might be, commonly used against us.
Ever since I've heard that a computer chip, brain cells grow naturally when placed on a computer chip, that just startled and shook me to the core, understanding what that means.
Yeah, I know.
And I see that they're continuing.
Yep, they're getting very bold about what's going on. And behind the scenes, you know it's going to be a lot more than this. Now, on to the Pope Francis, the simple wisdom thereof. We noticed in the last week he's been down in Mexico trying to pull all the Protestants into the faith down there and bringing joy and love and happiness to the Mexicans and trying to get the religions together down there. This Pope has been, in a short period of time, globe-hopping, globe-trotting to form that one world religion that he talked about in that 90-second video that he had, where he tried to get he showed the Muslims and the Jews and the Hindus and the Buddhists all coming together. He is definitely making a one-world religion. If you go to that, click on the printing underneath the Book of Wisdom, not the Book of Wisdom, you just get the front cover, but if you click on that printing, it says See More in the Vatican and Prophecy, and go over to that page. The first thing I've got up there is a picture that I created of the Pope, his hand up in the air, saying everyone is welcome, which is what he's saying, right? But I put three flying saucers up there with it. And why? Because the Vatican Observatory and the Vatican itself have been saying, well, if we have aliens come here, they're entitled to be saved too. And so, no matter what they look like, if the aliens or the fallen ones with Satan come and posing as messengers of light, he'll say, we welcome them. And he will recognize Satan and his minions, who will be supporting the leader of the world at that time, whether it be the Pope or some other person that does. The Vatican model through the Club of Rome will be global. And I'll tell you, watch for the Vatican making any announcements about this alien business. That's why I put that picture in there, to make a graphic image that'll stick in your mind. Watch for the connection between the Vatican and the Pope with the flying saucer or alien involvement. Oh, wow. Did you hear that?
Yeah, we heard that. We have no phones connected here, so I don't know how that happened.
Oh, it might have been Holly upstairs. She's on the line here. Back in Pope Gregory the 13th's time, he included a red dragon in his ornaments inside the Vatican there up on the wall, and on a coin that he had minted in 1582. Why the dragon is there, you'll see in this picture on that Vatican page I've got there. You'll see a serpent on the outside of the coin biting his tail, and he's around the ram's head or the sheep's head or something in the middle. And so what I see is the serpent encircling the peaceful sheep, let's say. I thought it was a strange thing for him to put up there with the red dragon and everything being part of it and encircling the church or the sheep.
We've
seen a lot of this of late, especially in modern pop culture. The Ouroboros, that symbol of the image snake biting its tail, the cyclical
from the entertainment industry to the actual Nephilim mounds conference out in Ohio. We went to and we got a book on all the different mounds out in the Midwest, that the one we visited actually had a trench dug right out of the earth, and it looked like from the aerial shots of a snake swallowing its tail.
Well, that's
another thing we can keep looking for and what's happening out there. Another point in prophecy. I'm still developing some of this. I haven't put up on the website yet, but is about, you know, everybody's saying, well, the Vatican sits upon the city of Seven Hills. And in essence, if you click at the map I've got there, the Vatican is actually outside the political purple line the red line that shows the Seven Hills of Rome. So the Vatican is over across the river from there. So technically you might say, well, in the prophecy, the city of Seven Hills, seven kings sit on seven hills. That may or may not apply to Rome. Athens has seven hills. Jerusalem has seven hills. Mm-hmm. Jerusalem has all the major religious sites there for, you know, Christianity, various descriptions, and Judaism, and Baha'i, and all that kind of stuff. They have their world headquarters type churches there in on top of that hill, or those hills that form Jerusalem. Greece with Athens, I mean, okay, you've got Cyprus really trying to come to the forefront and make deals with Israel and Iran. Maybe he is the bad boy that's going to be over the revived Roman Empire, 5 to the west, 5 to the east, 5 regions that are in that Club of Rome map I've got right above those images of Rome, or the Seven Hills of Rome. So the game's in play, and what we're doing here is putting the pieces out so that you don't say, it's got to be that city, it's got to be that guy. But they're going to be rolling around in people's minds that are trying to understand this, and that'll probably be mainly the watchmen. But put these pieces together and watch the news to see for, you know, leanings going toward Cyprus or toward Erdogan or, you know, toward the Pope, you know, and toward Rome or toward Jerusalem, where there's going to be a new temple built, and Turkey wants to build a temple down there and has been making overtures to Israel about that in exchange also for getting gas from Israel. It's such an incredible interwoven fabric. It's amazing.
Yeah, and prophecy continues to be fulfilled and unraveling before our eyes. And, you know, the prophecy of the Seven Hills is one that's been debated on for, forever, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I've been alive at least, and been in paying attention to this. And it goes back and forth, you know, whether they're talking about Rome or another area. But there are a few areas, as you just pointed out, other than Rome, that have and meet that description. And I wonder, I'm looking at the image that you have up on your website about those seven hills in Jerusalem or in Israel, and I wonder if how many of those were dedicated altars and ritual sites of idolatry back in ancient Israel.
Or, before that, in the time of the Assyrians and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
There are at least 50 cities I'm looking at here that claim to have been built on seven hills, including, you know, Rome, of course, but, Albany, New York, Athens, Texas, some of them, most of them, you can rule them out as ridiculous, but there's one in Amman, Jordan. There's one in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and that one is kind of a loose thing because if you look at it, Mecca is in the middle of several mountains around it, but not on top of it. You know, it's not like a city built on that, but using wisdom, you can look at these various things. But, Spain's got them, Hungary's got them, Ukraine's got them. But look at the ones that actually apply to the formation of the global government and the running of it in the Middle East or, you know, as far east, far west as Italy and stuff like that. But,
absolutely.
Yeah. And there's a lot of them there. Look up a list of cities claimed to be built on seven hills in Wikipedia, and you'll find it interesting. But, again, it's a number of puzzle pieces to put into the mix about who's doing what and what's fulfilling prophecy and what's not.
Stan, we've reached the end of the hour. You filled that hour with tremendous content and insight, and we thank you so much. And, again, we ask all our prayer warriors out there and people of prayer to keep Steve and Holly in your prayer.
Stan and Holly. Stan.
Oh, I'm sorry, Stan.
Oh, Steve, too.
God bless you, my friend. Thank you.
God bless you. Night, night now.
Till next week.
Remember to settle for battle, folks.
The Global Star Radio Network.